Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Spanners Reddy. We are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. I'm also joined by Matt Trumpets. Hello, Matt. How's it going, buddy?
It's going well. We've been blizzardified over here in New York.
Oh, I bet it's looking beautiful and crisp before suddenly everyone walks on it and ruins it and makes it a sludgy, horrible mess.
Yeah, we're right at the crossover between beautiful, pristine snow and mountains of gray sludge with intersection lakes to trap the unwary.
It's the weird thing about New York is it is either Arctic, Baltic conditions where magical things happen with giant Christmas trees, or it's so baking hot that the buildings themselves are trying to cook your face.
Yeah, we love it for just that reason.
Fair enough. If you ever want to escape the New York temperature, let's say on April 30th, why don't you fly here to where I am and have a slightly chilly karting day out with us?
Okay, although I am noticing a trend with lots of me tripping over there.
Okay, but there may well be. I can't talk about that yet, Matt, and you know full well that I might be coming to Murica in very early May as well. But for now, if you want to come go-karting with us, we are taking a little trip over to Norfolk near Lowestoft on April 30th. And what I would like is a bunch of people in my inbox with the subject line karting just saying, I'm potentially in. I want to see lots of names in my inbox so that I can go ahead and book that for April 30th. Email me spanners@missedapex.net just to say, ooh, that's interesting, or words to that effect. It looks like it's a little bit out of the way on the map, but actually we don't have to deal with the London traffic of our previous venue. So I'm hoping that we're going to get 50 carts on track. Let's go across to Bedfordshire from someone who I'm sure is going to come karting with us. It's our expert driver man, Bradley Philpott. Hello, Brad.
Hey, Spanners. How you doing? Yeah, I'll definitely be at the karting.
Is your 2022 F1 fan engine revving yet?
Yes. It's this time of year where I always have to go away for work to a very cold place. And I get by looking at testing, looking at car launches. And we're very, very nearly at that point. So I'm looking forward to that.
So yeah, you go off and do tire testing, extreme tire testing in cold weather. We always get lots of videos of you sliding around cold hangars or snowbanks.
Yeah, I'll be out in the snow testing winter tires. And every time I finish a run, or every time I've got Wi-Fi, I'll be checking my phone and looking at the new cars that are out and checking out the testing times.
Awesome. We're also going over to the other side of the world, and we're delighted to have Chester back in the shed joining us from Beijing. Good morning, Chester.
Yeah, very, very AM now here. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like four or five in the morning for you, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Four in the morning. But like, good evening to you guys.
I appreciate you joining us, especially it's a bit of a holiday. Yeah. It is New Year's Eve, I guess, Chinese New Year's Eve for you.
Yeah, Chinese New Year, Lunar New Year. So happy Lunar New Year, everyone.
Ah, fantastic. And does the car launch season create much fuss over in Beijing?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, at least on the internet, like, everyone is talking about, like, the supposedly leaked suspension from Zach Brown's phone and Mercedes, like, photo, you know.
Oh, I see. Matt, you can shed some light on that for us. I know we talked about McLaren a lot last week, but, yeah, there was a... Was it Scarbs that managed to do some investigative work?
Yeah, he was thumbing through the fire-up video, and I guess at a certain point the camera caught Zach taking a video of it for himself and inadvertently revealed that McLaren will be running a pull rod front suspension, which I believe has been 2009, 2010, 2011 was the last time they tried that. Ferrari, I know, had one in 2012, but it has not been a favorite of the Formula One teams. They've all been using the push rod. Okay. And I could even tell you why they might be doing it later on, if you like.
With apologies to Chester and Brad, since we're on it, why not just give us a quick rundown of why is that significant? I remember pull rod, push rod being a little bit like Bridgestone Michelin, which way were the teams going? It used to be important. Is it now?
Well, it is again for a couple of different reasons. You have lower noses. They've banned the push rod on upright, which was that trick that Mercedes used to get around things like the Monaco hairpin and stuff like that. And the basic aerodynamic configuration has changed. So there's going to be more advantage, potentially, in how the air flows through the pull rod suspension, which, if you think about it, it's that extra rod that normally starts at the top of the chassis and goes down. That's the push rod. The pull rod starts at the bottom and goes up. So it changes how the air flows into between the wheel and the car.
Okay.
And it might very well be advantageous. Top to bottom push rod, bottom to top pull rod. That's really all you need to know to identify it.
Okay, aero aside, Brad, I know you don't have a lot of aero car experience, but do these kind of suspension changes, do you think they'll relate to driver feel or driver style in any way?
So everything I've heard is that you can't actually tell the difference from the driver's seat, whether it's a pull rod or a push rod, because essentially the suspension is still being compressed in the same way. It's more, Matt will probably correct me here, but as far as I understand it, it's more to do with the airflow. It's an aerodynamic change rather than a steering or suspension feel change.
Yeah, they both do the same job in terms of absorbing the bumps. The difference is the pull rod has a lower center of gravity and is a bit lighter than the push rod. So that would be the lower center of gravity might also be an advantage this season in particular.
Okay, so I'm slightly bored of this because I can't understand it and that angers me. But is this going to be a thing where we suddenly see, oh, well, all the pull rod teams are doing really well and all the push rod teams are doing really well? Or is it more horses for courses and it's going to suit, you know, as long as you pick the one that suits your car, you'll be all right?
I think as long as you pick the one that suits your car, you'll be all right. But you might see that cars that have chosen a particular design route that includes pull rod doing better than ones that did push or vice versa. It's hard to say. It won't be a defining thing on its own.
All right, let's get into the big dirty news. Big dirty news. All right, let's start with car launch season. I'm going to ask the panel which car launches they're excited for. But do we have the dates, Matt, of which ones have been announced? I know there's one on Valentine's Day. So, we can't watch that one because the fake love Christmas card industry won't let you.
Yes, I know. We do have a list, courtesy of none other than Summers F1, who happily puts them out on Twitter. And Aston Martin goes first right now on the 10th of February. McLaren's on the 11th. Alpha Tauri has stolen Valentine's Day on the 14th. Ferrari on the 17th. And Mercedes is on the 18th. And Alpine is on the 21st. So that's what we have so far.
Okay, Chester, which of those launches gets your engine running? What are you excited to see?
I'm kind of really hoping Ferrari can do good like this year, like compared to the last two. And like, interesting, like, Red Bull is not in there. Like, I think they're one of the few that haven't confirmed that they're launch date yet. So something about a failed crash test.
Ah, okay. Well, that does bring us onto a subject. We'll cover those crash tests a bit later. But don't Red Bull traditionally like to launch their car on testing? And they like to do it at the track rather than have something snazzy? Or am I misremembering that, Matt?
Oh, maybe. I don't know. Red Bull, they're going to be on their own schedule this preseason, I suspect.
All right. And Brad's from a pretty car. Because it's just the colours, isn't it? That's all we're looking for when we see who's got a new livery. I must admit, I don't get very excited about them at all.
So no, for me, absolutely, the colours don't really come into it. I'm fascinated by what shapes all these cars are. And I don't really care which one, whether it's Williams or Red Bull or Ferrari. I just want to see the interpretations each team comes up with such a drastically different rule set. So I'm excited that we're not going to have, or hopefully won't have, teams like Red Bull, who in the past have released a render of the previous year's car. It's not even a real car they're showing us. They're just showing us a kind of new livery on an old shape computer-generated car, and then we only see the real thing when they actually hit the track.
I think years ago, you would have got more excited when there was less social media and less build-up to a season, because it would just be the first we knew about any of these cars. So we kind of get the excitement of it all at once, whereas the impact has kind of been softened, and there's not those big glitzy car launches anymore, really. I think I'm expecting all of them to be online affairs, perhaps with the odd awkward interview where you've got like a MC for hire, you know, they've hired in someone like me to just go, are you super excited about the F1 race car? Do you think you can beat Mercedes this year? Says the guy on a small fee. And the Williams manager's like, no, I don't think we can beat Mercedes, dude. But you have a lot of awkward car launches. But yeah, we don't really get to see a lot apart from this year, Matt. Seeing the new shape out of the box will be exciting, but that novelty will wear off fairly quickly.
Yeah, you sort of get one chance. And with the renders, it's always important to note that they usually obscure anything you might think of as an important detail.
Yeah. So, because Summers is in our live chat, actually. Hello, Summers. Matthew Summerfield from motorsport.com, the tech editor. But he is saying so that he can endlessly speculate, but they're not going to show the juicy bits during the car launches, are they?
No, they rarely do. And frankly, a lot of times, even when they get to the first test, anything they think might really make a difference usually doesn't show up till the last test.
Yeah. Well, speaking of tests, Brad, I'm a bit disappointed about the first test not only not being televised, but also they're not letting people into the stadium either, into the Barcelona circuit, and they've redefined it as a shakedown test now. The rumours are that Bahrain may have paid some money to be the first on-track action, and therefore Barcelona got demoted to being just a shakedown. But I'm going to miss it. Like you said, you have stuff on in the background. It doesn't need to be fancy. Just a couple of commentators, just the sound of some F1 cars going around. That's enough to get me starting to buzz for the F1 season.
It is a strange one that they've chosen to rebrand this as a shakedown, especially when some teams are already doing shakedowns at other venues before the shakedown. Mercedes, for example, are going to do what they've named a shakedown at Silverstone, which they generally do. But as long as we still get to see the times, which I believe we probably will, I mean, they'll get leaked if they're not shown live anyway. The fact that it's not televised, we never used to get it televised. We never used to get to. We got kind of auto sport updates and it was like text. And I quite enjoyed reading that anyway. So if we get something like that, they used to have like flatbed truck watch and, you know, they talk in great detail about what was going on with the recovery of different vehicles. It was all quite entertaining. So I'm fine with that.
Well, you'll be delighted to know there will be media at the circuit. So your live tickers from various sources that you enjoy will be up and running, so you can keep track of the times and who's doing what laps and whose car goes boom and catches on fire.
And Matt, are they forced to use the demonstration tires that they normally have to use at shakedowns, or are they using the full fat proper tires? Because I assume they're using the proper tires, and if they are, it's a test, isn't it?
I would be surprised if they made them run on the blocks of ice that they use for demonstrations at this. But it's what does really surprise me is as Spanners correctly points out, these have always been open to the fans in the past. You could buy tickets for cheap and wander around. It's usually not crowded, and see the cars on track. And they've closed it this time around. And Ferrari has run their own test, which there's some interesting stuff about that, in Fiorano the past week. And it was packed every day with fans. People are desperate to see these cars. And I'm surprised, and I wonder how much it cost Liberty to book this circuit and not let them sell tickets.
Well, this is it. They must have got, well, this is the speculation, that they must have got paid from Bahrain to, and this is, I don't have any inside knowledge on that, why would I, but that Bahrain have paid for the rights to be the first. And, you know, like in the Middle East, that is not without precedent. That is why we finish the season in Abu Dhabi, and presumably Bahrain is going to become also the first Grand Prix for quite some time. I'd imagine we're going to have season openers in Bahrain for quite some time. The disappointing thing is, and I this is rumour, someone tell me if this is true, that the price of the Spanish Grand Prix tickets included entry to testing. And so people have gone and bought tickets and booked hotels because they thought they were going to get to go, and they haven't been able to, because the website suddenly changed it to it's a shakedown. So if anyone's in that position, please email me feedback@missedapex.net so that we can get some more info.
Different kind of a shakedown, I suppose.
Yeah, a shakedown light. I don't know. Let's go for some more big, dirty news. It is very hard to follow news in the off-season in general, but there is an increasing hardness this season as the amount of news sources that are willing to just say anything or create a story out of speculation or just pure made-up lies and rumour is extraordinarily high this season. It's always been an issue, but there's loads of outlets just chucking out content. And we also have a lot of popular accounts online that have become popular in the last year and now also want to be kind of a news agglomerator as well and are in a rush to be the first to leak the story and be the sensation. And I'll admit here at Missed Apex, we probably had a little phase of trying to do that as well before we realised that it's probably more trouble than it's worth. But it is very hard to tease out what's going on, Matt. Apparently, well, I mean, Chester, you're the one speaking to me pre-show. Apparently everyone's failed a crash test.
Yeah.
Yeah, but everyone probably does fail a crash test, right, Chester?
I'm thinking about there's a lot of just social media accounts and like news sources that they just based on news on like some words somebody said like a few years ago, and
anything
like a lot of times I don't think there are a lot of the stories, but like this time I think it's the motorsport Italian division. I think they reported like supposedly Red Bull failed a like frontal crash test. It's not the first one Asian News designed a number 18 car that failed a crash test preseason. So I don't know. I don't think that this will affect them that much because they got experiences and like personnel to like update the monocoque and make it success.
Yeah, it sounds like failing those tests is just a perfectly normal part of doing business. You fail the test, you adjust the design, and then you take it again.
Yeah, like I think I would assume they were like pushing the limits of the performance, so they were like maybe on the edge, right? So they probably just failed a bit.
Yeah, and that will be a deliberate choice, won't it, Matt? To run performance versus reliability, you know, like Mercedes do, for example, with the air inlets. You know, they like to basically run as hot as they can, or do as little cooling. They always run the cooling on the edge. And, you know, in their testing, they'll probably run it to destruction. So why should a crash test be any different? But can we safely ignore all the crash test talk? Because it seems to come up every year. And I don't ever remember a team going, well, sorry, we're not turning up for the first race because, well, those crash tests, they're holding us back.
Yeah, you can pretty safely ignore all of that. In fact, I want to say that one season, and I do believe it was Red Bull, there was a rumor that they failed close to 30.
Oh.
Like front wing tests or nose tests before they finally got a design that would pass. And so, yeah, it is absolutely a part of the sport. If you're going to design at the absolute limit, you go for what you think you can get away with. And as you said, when it doesn't work out, then you just add a little bit back in until you pass the requirement.
Oh, actually, Brad, you just briefly touched on tyres because you were talking about going off tyre testing and you are, in fact, a performance tyre tester. What are you expecting from the new tyres? Because and also when you mentioned using demo tires. What are the differences between those things, and what are we going to expect from the 2022 tires?
Yeah, so just to answer the final part there first, when the teams do demonstration runs, they've got a certain allocation of a number of days each year they can run a current car, where it's for filming purposes, and quite often the teams will obviously double up and use that for checking systems and all that kind of thing. I'm sure a lot of the teams will be doing some drone filming and promo shots, but they're also actually checking systems in their new car. It's just an extra day of running, isn't it, really? But I think it's limited to 100 miles in the day. And they have to run on these essentially stone tires, like super ungrippy, slippery, horrible tires. So they can't, to try and prevent them using it as too much of a test day. So they look the same. You couldn't tell from the outside, but the demo run tires will not give you anything like the performance of the proper tires.
Yeah. So, you know, they can do things like stick a different driver in there just to get used to being in an F1 car, check that the exhaust doesn't fall off, but not get anywhere near ultimate performance. So, yeah, and we understand that as a shakedown or a TV day, so it really does make the calling of testing a filming day.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
And you asked about what I expect from the tyres, new tyres. Obviously, that's one of the major regulation changes. If it wasn't enough that the cars are totally different, the wheel size and tyres are very different as well. So a lower profile, less rubber, more wheel, and what I'd expect that to feel like, certainly as a driver, subjectively through the steering wheel, the car will feel a bit more direct, a bit more pointy, a little bit more immediate feel. That's the thing you generally feel when you make a sidewall smaller. You feel everything a bit more instantaneously because there's less flex going on through the only part of the car which is actually touching the floor. And obviously, the taller the sidewall, if you can take it to an extreme, think of something like a tractor or a lorry or a van. Obviously, as you turn the steering wheel, there's a lot of twisting going on in the sidewall before the contact patch touching the floor turns itself. So obviously, there's always this kind of twisting force going on in the sidewall, and the steering is doing one thing, and the bit of the tire that's stuck to the floor is doing another thing. And the less rubber you have there, the smaller the profile, the smaller, the shorter the portion of tire above the wheel and below the wheel, then the less flex and the more direct it's going to feel. It will also, though, mean that you should have a bit more understeer in the slow speed corners, because there's less mechanical grip coming from that flex and from the tire squishing around. It should mean there's more consistency in high speed, and the drivers will know what to expect a bit more. And hopefully a bit easier to manage the temperature of the tyre as well.
Okay, so can we point to a particular driver that doesn't mind a bit of understeer, or a driver perhaps that likes to really get in and point, via corner, that might struggle with tyres that are a bit more understeery in the slow corners?
I think in terms of the overall balance of the car, it's going to depend massively on the car itself, because it's not like that change in itself is going to be the thing that defines the handling characteristics of a particular car. Formula One cars are not the first series to go to lower profile tires. If you look at LMP1 or LMP2 or any sports car, really, they've all got this kind of profile of tire. And you don't hear about the LMP1 Le Mans cars being particularly understeery or anything like that. It can all be tuned with the rest of the car setup. It's just, in general, compared to the cars we have now, those are going to be the differences. I wouldn't even hazard a guess at which drivers that's going to benefit or hinder.
Well, thank goodness I'm here, because what I'm going to bring up is the fact that Alonso has spent a serious amount of time driving WEC cars that already had these size tires. Now, they were Michelins and not Pirellis, and the tires are constructed differently. But he, for one, and perhaps not surprising if you follow Alonso, thinks it will benefit him to have these bigger tires and wheels that he's used to from his sports car driving.
Oh, yeah, but wait for that to turn into, these tires only suit the British drivers. It's hot. Yeah, it's coming. It's coming. It'll be an excuse at some point.
And Brad is really onto something. These tires are very different to what the drivers have been used to, because they're designed to degrade less and to have a much wider thermal window than the previous tires. So they really are going to behave much differently to what they've been on, and it will be a learning curve, I think, for the drivers to figure out how to get the best out of them during their stint. So it'll be interesting for sure to watch.
And just as a very brief kind of precursor, we have seen these tires used in the test post-season at Abu Dhabi. And I think the general consensus was that they took a bit longer to warm up, which is exactly what you'd expect because there's less friction, there's less twisting, there's less heat build up from the tire moving around. So
yep.
That is what you'd expect. And hopefully that is going to contribute to an easier temperature management once they're up to temperature.
So then it will be interesting, Matt, to see if the thermal management has kind of been sorted and it can just be down to tire wear, that might make for more like, you know, tire tactics that we can follow as viewers. It's very hard to know, he's got no grip because he's out of the thermal window isn't very exciting. But being able to go, he's on lap 42, so obviously those tyres are starting to go. Do you know what I mean, Brad? Like, we can follow that more than out of its thermal window.
Yeah, I can imagine for most people watching, certainly any casual viewer, trying to understand that a tyre that's actually really new has run out of grip, even though it's got loads of tread. That'd be a really weird thing to think about, because on the road, everyone's used to tyres need replacing when they're worn out, not when they get warm. So we thought they were trying to warm the tyres up anyway. So you've got this conflict of...
And now they're too warm.
Yeah, they're trying to kind of keep it in a window, which is, it's not an exciting thing to talk about, is it? So I think you might be right there.
Tire temperature management, Matt. Yeah, it's not a thrill.
No, it's not. But I'm going to suggest that it could make the opening laps of races a lot more entertaining because don't forget, it's not just the tires that take longer to warm up, but the tire blankets themselves are going to be run at completely different temperatures this season as well.
All right.
And having said that, if I said the word Ferrari, and you thought loophole, would that be a bad thing?
What have they done this time, the sneaky Italians? What are they up to?
Well, you know, I mentioned briefly their test. And because of the change in regulations, normally you're not allowed to test a car, last year's car as a historic car. FIA had changed that because of the big change in regulations. Ferrari, we're going to test last season's car. But apparently, and I just throw this in because it's interesting to me, apparently someone complained about it because they'd already done their 2022 power unit upgrade. So they were actually forced to change and run an older car in their test last week.
So is this a reason for Ferrari people to get excited? Yeah. Okay. Look, Chester, you mentioned hoping Ferrari would be better this season. That hurt me because I thought we were friends. But what enamors you to the Scuderia Ferrari?
I don't know. I don't think I consider myself a Ferrari fan, but I just think like such a huge and successful team as the Ferrari, I think they should be at least fighting for a race win or two, right? Not like trembling in the midfield and at least not like 2020 when they're like a really bad SF1000, like just doing in the back. So I would hope like, and in the turbo hybrid era, I think there are like only Ferrari and Red Bull brought the fight to Mercedes in 17 and 18. So I would like really hope they can like step it up and bring the fight to Red Bull and Mercedes. But maybe they are not the front runner team this year. Maybe.
No, I don't think they would be. And Matt, people have called me a Ferrari hater, which I hate that they've correctly identified that. But I don't hate them like personally. I actually like Binotto and I like both their drivers now, which is really, really annoying. But I like them as rivals. So as much as I was like, after Fuelgate, I do want them back so that we being anyone that's not Ferrari, score some proper worthy victories against them. So I think Chester's got a point. It's almost like all is right with the world if they're up there challenging. It sort of brings F1 back to something more recognisable. I don't know. I don't want to fall into the trap of being one of these, F1 needs Ferrari. Just saying. F1 doesn't need Ferrari piddling about at the back. Matt.
Yeah, imagine Charles and Hamilton and Verstappen are fighting the front.
That's a good point. When you look at their drivers, Matt, imagine Sainz, Leclerc, all scrapping with Russell, Hamilton, Verstappen and Perez if he's allowed.
Yes. Well, I have some good news for you, Chester, which is while other teams have been headhunting top technical talent, it turns out that Ferrari has very quietly hired about 30 engineers from a variety of different teams to come join them in designing this year's car. And so, I mean, I do believe that they have the potential to make a step forward relative to their rivals. Whether it will put them all the way at the front on a weekly basis, I don't know. But you have every reason to feel very positive right now if you're a fan of the Scuderia, except for, of course, their entire history.
Yeah, look, I think Chester's, he initially revealed he's a Ferrari fan, then felt like he would come on under attack. And I think you've shied away. This is a safe place, okay? We welcome all fans, even Ferrari fans. I promise. It's okay, Chester. You can admit it.
Yeah, just don't admit that if we're Verstappen fan, right?
Oh, yeah, no, that'd don't do bad. That. That would be terrible. Yeah, looking at the iTunes reviews in the Netherlands, Matt, I don't think we're fantastically popular over there in Dutch lands.
Really? I can't imagine why that would be.
Because I think it's Brad's fault. Between you and me, I think it's definitely Brad's fault.
Maybe? Okay.
Yeah, but if anyone outside of the Netherlands wants to leave us an iTunes review, it really does help. 5-star reviews, you can criticize Matt's hair all you want, but as long as it's 5-star. So 5 stars, Matt's got terrible hair, is completely fine. 5 stars, how is Matt that old and still breathing? Can he walk and chew gum at the same time? That kind of thing, that's completely fine as long as it's 5 stars, Matt. That's what I...
Barely,
yeah, exactly. That will do. But it really does help. It gets us up the charts, which is really, really cool for us. And you can always share this link with your friends. Just share mistapex.net. It's nice and simple, mistapex.net. And that brings you to a homepage where people can look at the audio version, or they can come and see our faces on the video version as well. So just tell your friends, go to mistapex.net for all your F1 stuff. Okay, Matt, I think we should make Brad angry, shall we? No, let's not do that yet. Let's go over to Asia. We're looking at the start of the Grand Prix season, and we've got Bahrain on the 20th of March, Saudi Arabia, Australia, Monza. Oh, so we're into the European leg quite quickly. Then to Miami, and then, of course, back to Spain, Monaco and Azerbaijan. That makes complete sense logistically. Well done, F1. But there has been some track news, which is that Singapore has gotten a new contract for 7 years, but there's no sign of the Chinese Grand Prix. And that irritates me, Chester. We've got the wrong Asian Grand Prix secured. The Singapore Grand Prix does not thrill me at all, apart from looking visually exciting. But the Chinese Grand Prix is genuinely one of the best modern F1 tracks, especially that Sector 1. And it's just such a shame to have not seen it. Why, you tell me, why isn't it coming in 2022? I hold you personally responsible.
Yeah, I think something to do with the COVID restrictions.
Still.
So about the Shanghai circuit, I think it's a really, really fun circuit to drive, to race. But like sometimes the races are hit or miss. Remember the 1,000th race? It's like they hyped it up like so badly. And really fall flat on his face. So yeah, Singapore, I don't really like the circuit either. It's like stop and go, typical like street circuit thing. So for the Chinese Grand Prix, I've heard the Shanghai local government is really pushing to have a race, and I think they just got their extension to 2025, so it's not going away just yet. But until, like, I think after the Winter Olympics, so they were testing a so-called, like, closed-loop system. So, yeah, like, all the foreign athletes and, like, workers coming in, they are, like, in a closed loop. They're not, like, interacting with other people in the society. So if this turns out to be a success, I think they will try to bring maybe not 22, but at least 23 Chinese Grand Prix back.
Yeah, I have seen that it's supposed to come back in 2023 as well, and I think their contract runs through 2025, so it's not entirely over yet, let's hope.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as if you would struggle to fill that track. There's no problem. Like, if you hold a Chinese Grand Prix, Chinese people want to go and see a Grand Prix. There's an appetite for racing and F1 racing.
Yeah, especially like a new Chinese drivers coming in.
Oh, yeah.
It'll be really sad to if Joe just did 1 year and just never raced in his home country. I would like to see, like, even he's not going to do that good, but at least see him like race in his home country again.
So from your part of the world, what Grand Prix would you be tempted to physically go and see? I guess Australia is on the cards from there. It's not too far. I mean, well, to me, it's all over.
It's still pretty far. It's still pretty far. Yeah. Vietnam, if like it's not an option right now, but that'll be like the other. And also Japanese Grand Prix, I think that's one of the closest, and the circuit is very good.
Japanese Grand Prix, which is on the calendar this season as well, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So I know we like to criticize the Americans, Matt, for their geography or lack of, but when we were talking about the Miami thing that we weren't meant to leak or even talk about or even whisper, I said to the organizer, allegedly,
if we were talking about Miami,
I said, oh, I've got family in San Diego. I wonder if that's close by. And I looked on the map, like it could not be further away. It was like a whole continent away. And that's how we look at Asia as well. China and Australia, they must be close to each other. But let's go to Singapore. It's not a track that excites me. It looks spectacular. I'm assuming that it's got some economic, you know, viability, and there's the appeal to have it. I don't even know. I don't know if it's well attended. I don't know what the motivation for it being there is. But I don't like the track from a race day point of view. From a visual point of view, watching an onboard, it looks great.
Well, I can tell you right now that I believe it surpassed Monaco in terms of business deals done.
Oh,
attendance is always 100% and the parties are massive. And I hear the street food there is not too bad either.
I'll bet. So it's become the new jewel in the wallet, has it?
Yep. Which, well, you know, Formula One being a business, a certain amount of business has to happen.
All right. Well, we can get rid of the other one then, can't we? Brad, let's assume that my assertion that all street circuits are rubbish is correct. Why? In fact, get in my head. Why don't I like street circuits? Why, when we go to these tracks, Baku, Singapore, why do I go, oh?
I don't know exactly why you're thinking like that. But I actually do quite like street circuits, but I'll just go along with your
sake.
View. The reason that some people might not like them is that they sometimes don't look particularly interesting. The corners look quite samey.
Yep.
Having walls very close makes it often harder to go for an overtake. Quite often they're narrower than a non-street circuit, so there's actually not as much room to make an overtake. Monaco is the worst example, obviously. That's the real one you hate. And obviously, Monaco is nearly impossible to overtake because it is particularly narrow. Not all street circuits are like that. We've got quite a lot of variation in street circuits in Formula One. You've got somewhere like Baku or Singapore, you've actually got similar width to an ordinary track. I don't think it's as much of an issue. But then you do have other problems created by the walls being there. It's not just the room you have. They tend to bounce dust and marbles back onto the track. So you get this accumulation of slippery area near the edges. So it kind of does rule out some of the track for making passes.
And I don't know if it was Baku that someone said you can still feel the aero effects like 6-7 seconds down the road because the disturbed air kind of stays within the walls, Matt.
I think it was actually Singapore.
Oh, was it?
We were talking about qualifying. Remember that year Hamilton ran that amazing lap? And I think they actually used it to publicize the deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they were talking about 7-8 seconds back. Drivers were still running because this gets back to the can we create enough space for a qualifying run?
Yeah,
as we run out of time.
Can I address that miracle lap? Was it 2018 where Lewis Hamilton?
Yeah, 2018.
2018. Yeah, he'd been kind of struggling to get anywhere really in that session. As I remember it, I was only listening to it. I watched it back later, but he couldn't. He was struggling to get into Q3, and then suddenly pulls out this lap. And then, okay, I'm a Hamilton fan. Don't come hating, right? But people were going, oh, it's a Senna-esque lap. You know, when Senna was at Monaco going, with every lap, I felt the car more and more and I reached the ultimate thing. Surely, Matt, the credit has to go to the Mercedes strategists who told him how to treat the tyres exactly. Didn't he get there basically by just not using the tires at all?
He pretty much got out and pushed the car around until he got right before the straight. Then he got in and started so the tire temperatures, because everyone was, as you correctly, it was a year of the Hypersoft tire, pink tires. And everyone was just losing performance in the last sector. And he just managed to get the tires inside the sweet spot, kind of like a bullseye inside of a target, there's another sweet spot. And he got it perfectly there for almost a whole lap. And his improvement from his qualifying time was just, it was miraculous. It was amazing. It was just a feat of driving and engineering that, oh, you know, we were just lucky to see something like that, I'll be honest.
Yeah, but Brad, come on, that's got to be down to the strategists and the team picking through that data and then and spotting that sweet spot means you have to crawl around the lap. That's probably not like Hamilton just finding a genius 7/10 through perfect racing lines and braking points.
Yeah, I'm sure as with basically every good performance in motorsport, it's a combination of everyone in the team doing their job properly.
Okay, how often?
The driver still has to do it.
I've seen you take pole by like a minute before. I don't know. You've taken like massive poles at Nordschleife and you've been on pole by a long, long way. Have you ever had that thing where you just know you found a little engineering secret or a little tire trick or, you know, you had a massive car advantage that people didn't know about and everyone's hailing you as a genius and you go, yes, it was all me.
I'm sure that has happened. I can't think of great specific examples, but yeah, I mean, I did some karting in the last year in an extremely good team. And I knew, for example, that I definitely had better engines than most of the people on the grid. The kart was definitely better set up than most of the grid. You know, and you know that, especially if you jump from a different team into that one and you drive the same, but everything just goes way better and your lap times are better. So I have had those situations where you don't tell everyone that. You just say to everyone that you did a great job.
I just did as well as I could, and I ended up being amazed. But what about the nature of those corners as well, Brad? I think it's the first sector in Singapore, it looks okay. Because, I mean, there's street circuits and then there's street circuits. So they have like a little bit of an open bit that they've changed into a chicane. You look at, say, for example, the new Miami layout, and actually it looks like it's in the car park of a stadium rather than, you know, on the way to Tesco's. You know, it's not like the, you know, country streets. You're going past, you know, the Dickinson's house. You know, oh, there's Derek in number 42. It's not that kind of street circuit. Whereas Singapore is probably more genuinely a street layout with 90 degrees. I think that is that 90 degree stop start nature that kind of makes it go, I'm not interested.
Yeah, I mean, those kind of corners are just necessitated by the shape map of most cities, yeah, aren't they? Yeah, they, unless you do have a really wide open space that you can do something different with, or an old style city that happens to have more organically shaped corners, then that is just what you're going to end up with. And I think the fact you can't see through the apex quite often, you know, you can't, yes, really see what's the other side. The fact the corner, if they're 90 degrees, they're quite often not enough of a stop to be a really good overtaking point. There's various problems. I still don't have a problem with street circuits though. And I think I actually like the very varied kind of street circuits we have in Formula One. And I'm glad that we have street circuits on the calendar, because in the same way that I'm glad we've got a track like Monza on the calendar that's bizarre. And you know, I like the variation. That's what makes Formula One a really global sport for me, that tests different facets of driving than some other series.
Mark, I think you've hit a good point there, which is perhaps on the onboards at Singapore, it just looks like they're driving towards a dead end and then at the last minute they turn. And the opposite of that is Paul Ricard, where they're just driving, you know, in an indescript flat area, and then they suddenly turn. So you might have hit on something there. I'm very disappointed you didn't agree with me more about street circuits. Never mind. Matt, can we sort that? Can we only get people on who agree with me about street circuits? Can we add that to the admin list?
Sure,
of the show?
No problem. I'll put that on my list of things that I will eventually get around to doing.
Okay, well, Brad, what?
I do agree with you on a lot of other things, okay, though.
Oh, yeah, okay, fair enough. I'm just particularly disappointed about this one. That's all. That's fine.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Let's move on, Matt. Where should we head to? Oh, what's happening with Red Bull Honda? Because I thought the whole point they froze the engine regulations was so that the new Red Bull powertrains, the Tag Hondas, could have some time to catch up before they got homologated in 2026. Now they've basically said, oh, no, forget all that. We're staying with Honda. So surely we can just go freeze the engines this year now because there's no Red Bull powertrain.
Well, except technically there is. Honda is making the parts and assembling them and sending them over, but it's not a Honda power unit in the same way that it was before. And we know this because the chief of Honda's former F1 powertrain unit has now started his own consultancy to sort of act as a go-between between Red Bull and Honda. So essentially, Honda is building these power units on spec for Red Bull. All that's really happened is Red Bull's not doing the work at Milton Keynes, which was the original plan. And that's mostly because they're already needing to get ready. And I think this is why the other teams didn't fight the engine freeze too hard. They're already needing to start getting ready for the 2026 brand new power unit regulations.
Matt, can I just to clarify something? Because yeah. I was under the impression from all the coverage and all of the farewell Honda stuff that Honda were actually like pulling out and Red Bull were just going to kind of continue that contract, use the basic architecture, but they've got this whole new engine development area in Milton Keynes.
Yeah.
If it's still a Honda design, fundamentally, it's the same engine that they've been using up until this point, especially because it's frozen and it's being built by Honda. What makes it not Honda? I can't see anything other than we're just being told it's not Honda. Like, it is though. Like, I can't.
Jose in our chat. I'm just gonna say Jose in the chat has just gone. If it quacks like a Honda,
fair enough. I think the issue from Honda's point of view had something to do with intellectual property rights and the fact that Red Bull, as you know, has been flirting with Porsche quite a bit. And I think they were concerned about losing control, whether vertently or inadvertently, of some of that if they let the manufacturing happen at Milton Keynes. Do you understand? Am I making my point clearly enough? They're worried that Porsche might snag some of their ideas if they let the manufacturing happen at Milton Keynes, and they preferred to keep it in Japan. And Red Bull were okay with that, because they get the same result regardless of where the parts are done. They probably get better quality control because it's being made by people with more experience, and they can just bring the Porsche people in to start setting up shop and working on 2026 at their home base, which is what they're probably going to wind up doing anyway.
So maybe I missed something, and sorry if this is a really dumb question.
No.
Why have Honda pulled out if they're still having to do all the work and just not get any of the glory for it? What was the pullout for?
It wouldn't be Honda if they don't pull out like Formula One when they're immediately going to have some success.
What's the take from that part of the world of Honda? We heard a lot of differences in culture led to disagreements with McLaren and Honda, and the clashing philosophies and making that relationship difficult. But they seem to have eventually made it work at Red Bull. It was a surprise almost to see them pulling out. So I was a bit lost as to why Honda wanted to pull out in the first place. Chester, what's your take on that?
I have absolutely no idea like why they pull out. I think maybe it's because like the cost thing, and they see they all have like a major upgrade in 2021, and this like the last push to help Red Bull to win the title, which they did. But like, as for why they decided to do that, maybe Matt will give us an answer.
It's just money. It's expensive, very, very, very expensive to run research and development. And as a manufacturer, you're essentially giving your engines to your customers at a loss. And since Honda didn't have their own team, then they don't also reap the marketing benefits that the teams, like Mercedes has a Mercedes team, so they get all the marketing benefits of winning championships in a way that power unit manufacturers do not. So what's essentially happened is Honda has said, we don't want to lose control. We don't want to spend money. Red Bull said, fine, we'll pay you to make the engines in Japan and ship them to us and AlphaTauri. And everybody thinks that's going to be just grand.
Brad, I don't know. It's not sitting well with me. It just seems a bit too convenient for my liking.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. You've kind of already touched upon it. I thought the whole point of having this freeze was because it was like, okay, we won't be too hard on Red Bull, who are going it alone, you know, having to develop this engine on their own and being a new engine manufacturer.
And that's good for F1, so we want to encourage that.
Yeah, they are actually just literally keeping it with the manufacturer. The second thing that I wanted to just ask, again, this is a genuine question. I don't know the answer. If they're now paying for engines, so obviously with being a Honda Works team, they wouldn't have necessarily been paying for the engines. It would have been just part of the deal. Honda are getting the marketing benefit. If Red Bull are now paying for that, how does that affect the cost cap? Does that not really suddenly mean they have a much bigger chunk of their budget? Or is that already taken into account? Was Honda's spend on engines already part of that? Or do engines not count at all?
So as a team, I buy a supply of power units for between 15 and 20 million a season. Red Bull is doing that. But there's now Red Bull Power Units, which is a separate company, which is responsible for the development of the power, for the construction and development of the power unit that goes into the Red Bull. Red Bull Power Units, which may not be its actual name, is essentially paying Honda to make that for them. So essentially, Red Bull has become the Tag Heuer in this situation. But the difference is, because Red Bull are still funding it out of their because it's coming out of like the big Red Bull Corporation, not just Red Bull Racing, they are behind the eight ball relative to Mercedes and Renault and everybody else, and especially in terms of the amount of spend that they would need to make that R&D happen, because Honda's not going to do the research and development. They're happy to build it. They know how to do that, and they can make money at it. They don't want to spend more money chasing more performance. And that's why the engine freeze originally came in, because Red Bull were picking up the financial reins of having their own power units.
Okay, so before we leave this, in fact, no, this fits in with what I'm going to do next. Let's fix F1 by changing stuff. That's a super snazzy title for a segment, isn't it? Let's fix F1 by changing stuff. I like that. So I want suggestions from you guys about how to change Formula 1. But I want to look at the current engine rules, Matt. I had an epiphany about the engine rules and the fact that you get a penalty for exceeding your three engines. So you get a penalty, you're doing something wrong. Is it okay from a sporting point of view to accept that penalty as part of racing, like Mercedes did in Brazil? They deliberately broke a rule, which is you're only allowed to have three engines, and they said, no, well, we'll have more. Hardly an uncommon thing. Pretty much every team has exceeded that at some point. But they showed in Brazil, with a really superior fresh engine, they could go absolutely nuts. They could win it from everywhere. So what's to stop them in 2022, periodically, every three races, just chucking a new power unit in, going, oh no, 10-second grid penalty, what will we do? As they just breeze past the entire grid. I'll go for you, Chester, first. Would you consider that cheating if Mercedes did that?
I mean, like, it's allowed in the rules. So if you take a new power unit, you take the 10-grid penalty and five afterwards. So if that's in the rules, I think you can say they're cheating. But, like, I think it's against the spirit of the rule, which is, like, to, you know, to be more efficient with the engines and not, like, have a, like, dedicated qualifying engine just run one lap and have it blow. So I think it's against the spirit of the rule, but I don't know. Are they changing it? Like, so maybe No. I think if they change it to like have more severe penalties, so it's like a like between now, if you take a new one, you get 5, and like maybe you get like 10 or 15.
So oh, it goes higher. The middle ground, yeah.
Like, so yeah, so it goes higher, but not too high. Like you can't like stack it together like the McLaren Honda days. They stack like a 60-70 grid penalties together. Not that.
No.
That'll be pretty hilarious, yeah.
But why? What would stop them from running 7 new engines in the first 7 races, taking their grid penalties, and then just having, you know, whatever, 19 races left, 17 races left, where they've just got this pool of relatively fresh engines, and they can just go hunting for the rest of the season and 2013 Red Bull it?
I think Brazil is like a pretty special case, right? I think they had the new engine for it, and it's really, really fast. But I don't think it'll work like every circuit, right? Like some of the circuits are pretty hard to overtake.
Yeah.
Even if you have like a brand new engine has like 20, 30 horsepower more than the other engines.
Yeah, so you'd have to pick your circuit, Matt. But I think there's some strategists out there now listening going, nice one, Spanners, we'll have that. And tell you what, it's yours. You can have any strategist, you can have that tactic, not you, Ferrari.
It's right. So if it's within the current scope of the regulations and you don't violate the cost cap, because it will depend on the contract you have with your power unit supplier. You know, are you over 4 power units? Are you paying extra for them? Well, now that's a problem. On the other hand, if you've simply paid a lump sum for a season supply, then that's a different thing. But I think if you're a power unit supplier, how you view that is it will cost extra money unless you show us an engine that is no longer functional.
But if you're Mercedes, you dictate the cost of the engine. Go, hang on, Mercedes, you've had 10 engines. You've only got 15 million. How much are those? Oh, well, these ones. Bargain these ones, right? Honestly, right, I got them off a pallet with a bunch of lawnmower engines, 1.5 million a piece. Wouldn't believe it. That's what I said. I said, you're letting me rob you, pal. But he said, no, 1.5 million an engine. Though they can dictate the price. I don't think that's a major drama.
Yeah, no, but the other thing to consider is we don't know if, in fact, there will be some sort of rule about that, because the last draft of the sporting regulations, as Summers has helpfully pointed out, although we've discovered this before on our own, is from last April. We don't actually know a great deal about the sporting regulations. They're not complete, and they're from a long time ago. So it's entirely possible that the penalties will have been changed for this exploit, let's call it.
Yeah.
And so it will no longer be possible.
They'll close the Spanners loophole. Okay. Mark in our live chat said, never in the history of F1 has any team spent any time worrying about the spirit of the rules. And I think that might be true to an extent. Although I do feel like Mercedes have occasionally hobbled themselves with the spirit of the regulations and a sense of general fair play. Like I don't think they would have done what Red Bull did with Perez, like literally like slow down for, you don't think so, Brad? You know, the slow down for the DRS, hold him up in the corners. I'm not sure Mercedes would have ever deployed Bottas quite to that extent. So I think that yes, the teams will go to exactly what they can get away with, but I feel like Mercedes are held back by this little bit of sense of fair play.
If that's true, then I'm a bit sad, because I would hope any competitive team would do what Red Bull did with Perez. I think the problem is Mercedes haven't had a driver capable of doing that. Bottas just doesn't have that in him. And you've seen every time he's been asked to even hold another driver up for one corner.
Yeah, he's not been able to. That's a good point. Yeah.
So that just wouldn't have worked, I don't think, with Bottas, which I still find bizarre, just going off on a slight tangent, that someone can get all the way through the ranks winning things like GP3 and having a successful karting career and not have somehow remembered all the racecraft that you have to have to get through those ranks.
Yeah.
But anyway, for whatever reason, no. Bottas seems to have lost that in
Formula 1. You're right, because I was following this at a time after you had been teaching me basic racecraft, because you'd always said to me, yeah, I can steer the wheel reasonably, but I have, to quote you, zero racecraft. So when we were talking through like attacking and defending, like it was like basics, like where do you position your car? Are you going to defend the inside or the outside? Well, that's decided kind of by how it plays out. So you go in the middle, and then if the other car chooses the inside, then you can squeeze them to compromise their line into the next corner. We didn't see any of that from Bottas. He would just pick a line immediately and the other car would cruise past. We saw it time after time.
And then the next layer where when you're in the middle of the move where they're trying to get the cut back on you and you just check up your speed in the middle so they can't do their cut back because the momentum they've gained by going wide can't be used because you've positioned your car just to be in their way. All the stuff Perez was doing at Abu Dhabi. And he did it really well. I held nothing against Perez for that, even though I was obviously backing Hamilton at the time to win that race. I was pleased seeing Perez do that because that's what I think everyone should do in that position. The same as I was happy that Hamilton did everything he could in his power to back Rosberg into the pack when that was his only way to win the championship all those years.
Yeah, ago. Yeah, but that was not Mercedes. That was Hamilton. I'm sure Hamilton would want to do the Red Bull style, but Mercedes just seemed to be held back a bit by that sense of fair play.
Yeah, I can't think of any other examples though, and I certainly think the season we just had will have fired them up to try and avoid too much of that. I think they want to come across as being professional, corporate, fair, but I think they will have maybe learnt from Toto's kind of outburst on the radio that gives you really bad PR when you do actually, when you're kind of vocally too aggressive in your kind of attitude as a team. They'll do stuff, they'll take things to the limit behind the scenes, but I don't think they'd necessarily want to come across as anything less than squeaky clean.
So slightly on that point, I feel like when there was Mercedes domination in 2014, 2015, 2016, I feel like from a development point of view, they didn't want to embarrass F1 and they didn't want F1 to look bad. So I always got that feeling that they maintained a gap, and if a team got close to them, they would then bring out upgrades. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't think they're going to do that in 2022.
Yeah, it's a different thing, isn't it? When you're so far ahead that it's almost embarrassing.
Yeah, embarrassing, yeah.
When you've got such a margin, then you can afford to be more nice to your competitors and be more fair. But when you're in what do you call it? A barroom brawl. You need to just do anything you need to.
Get dirty.
I think that's kind of what we saw. Yeah, exactly. Get dirty. I think that's what we saw in the season just past.
Yeah, for me, the line always was Mercedes, and I hate to use Red Bull, but it's just because or I guess we could use Ferrari. Let's take the Ferrari power unit. Their agreement that we don't know anything about, but everybody kind of knows exactly what happened. I don't think that's a thing Mercedes would do. I think Mercedes will be clever. I think Mercedes will, within whatever rules exist, but I don't think they would actively design a system that violates what the stated rules are. Like, say, they will exploit the gray area, but I think Mercedes as a corporation has a line and an image to protect. And I think you're right about that. Whereas I think other teams will, the question they ask themselves is, will I get caught? And if the answer is there's a less than 50% chance, they're liable to do just exactly that thing.
Fair enough. Let's continue with our ways of fixing F1. I think we've got 5-10 minutes left, and then we're going to do another meet the panel for you. We did a Twitter Spaces, Matt and I did, which I think went quite well, Matt. I like that. It's a Twitter thing where basically you and I can chat and then people can ask to also be a listener and talk to us. And we were asking people to suggest stuff. It worked very well. I liked it.
Yeah, especially the bit where you ran away at the end and left me to close everything down with no way to actually close it. That was my favorite part.
I might not have got all the technicals shaken out. And that was actually part of the reason I did that one, low-key, without telling anyone. I just wanted to see if it worked. But we'll do those publicly. We're also going to do some patron-only ones as well. We have like a patron account that you can follow on Twitter and join us in the spaces. And I'm hoping that we can eventually use those for calling. So we'll keep doing those. Stay posted for information, or why not go and join us over at missedapex.net. And you can see a link to our Patreon page. You can go straight to that if you want by clicking on patreon.com/missedapex and be a patron supporter and get involved in all the fun stuff we do there. So next thing to change in F1. I'm looking around my panel to see who has won. Let's go to Brad. What are you going to change about F1?
Okay, so I'm open to being shown why this doesn't work.
Okay.
But off the top of my head, having thought about it for 24 hours, I would get rid of full safety cars from a fairness point of view. Now, I understand why we have, or why we're told we have full safety car, where the field is entirely bunched up in order to allow clearing up of incidents, to give the marshals the longest possible time without any cars in that area of the track. So I understand that. But I have definitely seen other series where incidents happen and things need clearing up, where safety cars don't exist. And the race is neutralized, as we have with the virtual safety car. Everyone has to slow down to a speed at which they're not able to lose control. And they have to just avoid the incident and just drive around it. You know, it's quite rare that there's a crash actually blocking all of the track that needs a lot of tending to.
In which case, you'd red flag that anyway. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So I don't see why in a lot of cases we need to unfairly benefit some cars or penalize other cars when there's an option to keep the gaps the same. Mm. Effectively, even at indoor kart tracks where they have a button that they press when there's a yellow flag and all the carts drop to the same speed. It's virtual safety cars work. We've got this delta thing nailed now. And even if you need a particular slow zone around the incident, that mini sector could have a lower speed limit. And then the driver could get, could be allowed to use more speed in the next sector to then catch back up to the gap.
Yeah.
I'm sure this is technologically doable. So that's my suggestion for a rule I think we should change.
Well, I mean, okay, let's go to Chester. There's many ways to deal with an incident. I feel like we've had more safety cars in the last few years. Like, I feel like we've had entertainment-based safety cars have increasingly come into play.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm going to say. It's like, I think the race director for the past few years are like intentionally like having standstill starts and safety cars just to get the audience hyped about the race and not really caring about like the fairness in the race. So I think that's one of the reasons, even though like there are definitely like technologies for them to put in place to make sure it's all fair and similar to the VSC. But I think for the entertainment prospect, they will still try to get as many as possible safety cars in there.
Yeah, it's like Matt, they came up with this perfect solution with the VRS and then instantly realized, safety car is more exciting.
Well, to an extent, but let's consider that even with the virtual safety car, people gain and lose time.
Yeah,
don't maintain perfect distances.
Yeah, but it's orders of magnitude more fair than completely bunching. You know, you could have someone who's almost an entire lap down and they then get to be right back on the back of the leader if they're in second place, for example. Whereas virtual safety car, maybe they'll gain or lose a second here and there.
Yeah, so like Imola, where Hamilton should have been just out of it completely, just by that slight quirk of staying on the same lap. And then being the unlapping yourself, like if we could just get rid of that entirely, there's got to be a better way to solve that. But he was able to unlap himself completely, get to the back of the pack, and then go and fight for points. Obviously, there's a lot of controversy about how to end a safety car, Brad. But yeah, it definitely feels like overkill when it comes to safety cars. There's too many things going on. The unlapping yourselves, the being able to pit, the bunching up, the bunching up on its own would be enough. But there's a lot of odd rules around it as well.
Yeah, that's my feeling. And I know people will actually have the opposite thoughts to me on this. Some people will want there to be more of this. The Daytona 24 Hours finished today. And in that race, there are lots of safety cars, a real high number of safety cars. If someone spins, it's immediate full course caution. Mm. Everyone catches up and the classes are then allowed to pit. And what happens is you end up with cars who are several laps down, still being in contention for the win at the end of a 24-hour race, because every time there's a safety car, someone at the front of that, who's a lap down but near the front, gets to unlap themselves and get back on the pack. And in fact, a car that was fighting for the win in the final few minutes was two laps down when I went to sleep last night. They get that back purely from the safety car. But I don't like that. I don't think that's very pure. I don't think that's very fair. I don't think you should be able to get those laps back. So for entertainment, some people might like it, but it actually diminishes my entertainment.
So the time I saw, this is going too far, was when they started talking about instead of a normal safety car restart, they would grid up after a safety car. And that's when you got going, oh my goodness, not only do they just want more safety cars and we're doing more competition safety cars, but also they want to manufacture a standing start when normal restarts are fine. They're broadly fine. I mean, they're safe. you still get a chance to attack and defend. But no, they wanted the carbon fiber zone again of the standing start. And then they realized that that's a bit of a faff, getting people to grid up, knowing exactly where you're going to grid up. There was problems with that. And then that's where we started getting the, well, we'll just red flag it. We'll just red flag it and then we get to start again. And it's gone from rugby to NFL. And no one will get that reference on either side of the pond. But it's gone from a flowing game to a stop-start game. And I think that might be the future.
Well, I would actually suggest that from a safety point of view, what happened in Mugello is a very good argument for not having the safety car and the rolling restart the way it is. I think you're better off either with a virtual... That was when, remember, the cars were letting two big gaps and they were speeding up and then like seven cars smashed into each other at full speed.
Oh,
because one person had to slow down because the race hadn't actually restarted
that
yet.
That was last year. 2020. Okay. That was 2020. Yeah.
So from that point of view, I think you have a real point. I think the issue that's immediately going to come up and relative to sports cars is that the Formula One cars just don't like to be driven that slowly. If you do need to bunch the cars up, then you're going to have to red flag the race and bring them in and do a standing start.
Okay. We're at the end of the news. We are going to do some meet the panel. But before we go, I want you to go and follow Chester on social media. Where should we send people, Chester?
Just follow the podcast. It's called Feng Cheng Shi Man Tan, if you speak or listen to Mandarin podcast. Okay. So give us a follow, subscribe, and maybe a 5-star review. Just give Mist Apex a 5-star review as well.
Oh, okay. That was very magnanimous of you, but we'll try and get a link in the show notes so any Mandarin speakers can go and check you out. And you're on Twitter as well, Chester?
Yeah, but I don't really post anything, so I don't see a point following me on Twitter. Maybe, yeah.
Okay, we'll just give him a vanity follow, guys, anyway. Search for a Chester on there. We'll put a link in the show notes, and do follow Brad as well. Brad, are you still on Twitter? You still doing Twitter and stuff?
Yeah, occasionally. I'm looking forward to building my following more in the coming season, commenting on the new cars and all that kind of thing. So I'll be giving lots of opinions in the next couple of months before the season starts.
Go and follow Brad at Brad Lee Philpott. I thought you were going for Brad these days to be more cool and young sounding.
Yeah, so I've changed the name that gets displayed to Brad Philpott, but Twitter won't let me change the actual handle, I don't think so. It's at Bradley Philpott and Brad Philpott on YouTube if you want to check out some... If you want to learn how to drive the Nürburgring, for example.
There's lots of good content on there, and actually Brad, I'm hoping, is going to coach my Mist Apex team, who's entering your Nordschleife iRacing competition on March 12th.
Yeah, well remembered. Yeah, 12 hours of the Nürburgring on March the 12th. Yeah, we've got getting on for 60 teams entered now. Not quite. We're about 55. And you guys make up 4 or 5 of those teams.
We've got 9, Brad. Don't underplay it. We are entering the amateur phase like the amateur class, like a sledgehammer. And by that, I mean we're going to be breaking the barriers and causing... Well, we'll test your safety car theory. I think we're going to make it so you have to throw some safety cars. And you can test yourself against Brad as well, because I'm really hoping you're going to come karting with us on April 30th as well.
Yep, I definitely am. And case in point, there are no safety cars at the Nürburgring Nordschleife. All localized.
Wow.
Neutralized zones.
All right. That's actually pretty surprising. Do come and join Brad, and I'm hoping Matt will fly over and the likes of Catman and Kyle and Alex Van Gene. Come and race with us in Suffolk. Send me an email. I'm so close to booking it. Just send me an email to spanners@mistapex.net with the subject line karting and just say, like, I'm interested, and I want like 30 or 40 of those in my inbox tomorrow afternoon, and I'll go ahead and book that. Follow Matt at MattPT55. And Matt Trumpets on Facebook. And you don't have to mouth it. The reason I'm going to you now is so that we can play the game.
Comment of the week.
I hadn't forgotten. I was doing the whole thing. We're doing Meet the Panel in a minute. We're doing Comment of the Week now. Chester, you're the judge, so make sure you're listening in. Matt, there have been comments in our Patreon live chat. Tell us who the nominees are.
All right. We have many nominees today, but I'm going to start with Stuart Neal. Haas do slow-mo filming without a special camera. When we were talking about filming days, of course.
Super mean, Chester. I would urge you away from that. That's so mean. Go on.
Our friend Mike Stoner says, who likes crash test? Dummies!
Mike Stoner did the theme tune for this week. So thank you very much. I've been delighted. We've had like 6 or 7 entries so far, and I'm going to play the ones I like, the strongest ones, and we can all come together and pick one before the beginning of the season. I get like 10 votes though. Next, Matt.
I think we're going to go with EJ. All the time you have to leave the pace, talking about Alonso and his sports car tire experience.
Okay.
And we have 2 more to go. We have Maria Ferrari, Maria Kleros. I apologize. Ferrari is like Cruella de Vil, but you have no story without her.
I don't like the, oh, they need them. But if they're here, if they are, F1 would survive without Ferrari. But if they're here, they may as well participate up the front instead of mucking up the midfield.
And last but certainly not least, we have Daz the Gardener with the almost unanswerable question of what is the speed at which Mazepin can't lose control?
Hey, maybe he is just pushing to the limits where other drivers aren't. Chester, do we have a winner?
I guess I have to give to Mike Stoner, who likes crash test dummies.
Comment of the week.
Brilliant. Go and follow my panel, please, today. And all the links we've talked about to Chester's podcast, to everyone's social media, is in the show notes below, as well as a link to go and support us at patreon.com/MissedApex. Be a patron. Come and hang out with us in our Slack group. Get the extra content that's going to start probably in late February onwards. We're going to have 2 patron shows a week. Join in our spaces and we'll have lots of live stream stuff as well. And you'll be the first to know about Missed Apex events. Now, where we're going next is into my shed, where I want you to meet my panel on a more individual basis. I put it at the end of the shows because we might stray away from Formula One almost immediately. So I've sat down with my crew one-on-one, got personal and just a bit nosy. And then the next one is coming up now. Introducing one of our oldest Missed Apex panelists, but also one of the youngest Missed Apex panelists. Don't worry, it will make sense. It's Chris Stevens. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Spanners.
I forget, even though you're teeny tiny Chris Stevens, you're so desperately young. How old are you?
24.
Oh, is it really? That's not that young anymore. Okay. But when
it was like 18
was
when
it?
I started this, yeah.
Oh, really? So when I met you at first, you were 18. You were working in retail and you were blogging. You were doing Formula One blogs.
Yeah. And I think at that point, I just started venturing into Formula E as well.
Yeah.
So doing some actual like on-site stuff.
And what impressed me was you were a very good writer, but not in a kind of self-indulgent way. You weren't saying, I have considered motorsport and the way it flutters through my soul. You weren't doing any of that. You were really getting down to these things happened. These are the things that are important and that you should pay attention to. And, you know, and as a fan reading your stuff, I always felt like very zoned into what was going on. No wasted words. And I just thought you were an excellent journalist, basically.
Oh, thanks, man. I really appreciate that. Obviously, I was very lucky to have some very good training from Autosport at the time. This is when they were still running the Autosport Academy.
Now,
and bringing in very young people.
You were an Autosport junior. Now, that's a really interesting thing because, I remember seeing you running around the Autosport event they have in the NEC Birmingham. What was that like, the experience of being an Autosport junior?
It's really, it's a great thing that they did. And I certainly wouldn't be the writer I am now or indeed the person I am now without that experience. I was given quite an important role in their national side of things. You know, it's where they put the juniors on the national side. It's where you learn the craft basically on a sort of smaller scale. But they gave me the 750 Motor Club in my first year. And in terms of national racing, that was a really big gig, and they would never really normally give it to somebody of with the experience I had at the time and at my age as well. I think I was 17 or 18 when I started doing it. And so, and I think in a way I may have been too young looking back on it because I definitely didn't utilize the tools I had available to me, which is easy to look back at now and say, yeah, I could have done a bit better. But I think it was certainly career changer because it's like a stamp of approval you know, it was like, yeah, Autosport like me, so everyone likes you.
Yeah, well, actually, your maths is wrong. You were 17 when you first started doing stuff with Missed Apex podcast.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because I remember you getting accepted to the Autosport Junior program. But I don't know, what was it like in those early days jumping on board? Because when I said you were one of our oldest, youngest panelists, actually, I'm trying to think of any of the panel that were on before you. It's only Matt and Chris Catman-Turner.
Yeah.
And then you're the next longest serving mapper.
Yeah, proper OG mapper. Because in those times as well, I was producing some stuff as well.
You don't bother your ass anymore.
No, downscaled a little bit since then. But like, I stood in for you a couple of times on the main show.
Yeah, and I forget. Look, this is one of the strengths of Missed Apex podcast. I've always felt like, you know, we have a rotating panel, so we can have someone drop out and have someone come back in. And actually, Matt has been so steady for the last couple of years that people forget probably that you were standing in as the second chair. You were the Matt Trumpets on many occasions.
Yeah. I think we can thank COVID a little bit for his steadiness, unfortunately. He's become just part of the stable. Part of the furniture. And I love what he does. And I loved doing the role that he does as well. And obviously, I'm always so keen to contribute more to the show. I'm really looking forward to Sunday when we get to do our season review.
You've given away that we have recorded this far, far in the past before we even did our 2021 season review. But yeah, you were always ready to step into Matt's shoes to fill in. And the reason I like going to you is you have a skill for having your finger on the pulse of motorsport news in general. You're kind of encyclopedic, a little bit like Catman. And I can go to you on any topic, especially with drivers and their junior programs as well, because you're following probably a broader stream of motorsport than me, who tends to focus in very much on F1.
Well, it's kind of part of the job, especially when I was a journalist, and I think even more now that I'm in PR, you have to have at least a general idea of what's happening in most disciplines. I do have a gap in the knowledge. Everyone does. Like rallying. If you ask me what on earth is happening in rallying, I couldn't possibly tell you. But it's about keeping on top of not just what's happening in Formula One, what's happening in the junior formula, what's happening in the World Endurance Championship and sports car racing in general, because it has a huge impact on the rest of motorsport. And, you know, my job in PR at the minute, we work in single seaters, we work in endurance, we work in Formula E, we work in so many different disciplines. You have to know what you're talking about. And the limit, it doesn't just stop at, oh, this is who's winning races and this is who's doing well. The sheer level of knowledge at a political level that you have to have is really, really important, because motorsport is a sport for 2 hours, maybe on a Sunday afternoon. The rest of the time, it is politics.
Yeah, and a lot of the time when we're having conversations, that politics and that knowledge helps you put things into context. And actually, for someone so little and tiny and young like you, you do give us a lot of context, which is why I'm always happy for you to play the Matt role. And actually, with Matt, I do have to bully him occasionally to take holiday, because he is that passionate. He loves being on Missed Apex so much and does a lot of the prep and the production as well. But yeah, I have to I have to dob him in on his wife and say, I've told Matt he can have that week off to go and do that thing. And but your PR schedule hasn't been the best for us. I'm hoping that in 2022, you will be able to jump in, because like Matt, I can just bounce anything off you and I know it's going to come back.
Yeah, 2022 is going to be quite a big year for me. I've got a big shift going on that hopefully I can talk more about at a later date. I do hope it means I have some more time for this kind of thing.
It had better, because I always threaten Matt when he's going on about tires or whatever, or engine modes. I'm like, okay, do you know what? I could replace you with Chris or Kyle at a moment's notice. But let's talk more about Chris the person. Things I like about you. No, let's start with things I dislike about you. You are far too tactile. I, you know, I'm a very hands-off kind of person, but you always come in for a big hug, and that makes me incredibly uncomfortable, but also loved.
I'm a hugger. I can't help it.
But you are a very jolly person. Whenever we have socialised, you always throw yourself into those events, especially the Mist Apex karting events. I just love seeing you grow into the character of Mr. Mist Apex comms.
Yeah, I love it. Honestly, the one we did at Butmore Park in 2019, that was a highlight of my year.
Oh, that was the last one. Oh, that was the latest one. I've tried.
At some point, we were talking about doing four of those in a year, like one per sort of season.
I still want to do it. I still want to do it. Well, we did do three in 2019, to be fair. We did three.
Including the esports thing as well.
No, we did three karting events. We may have only had commentary for two of them. But yeah, that was the plan. And in 2020, I had to cancel two because everyone was like, oh, COVID. Yeah, that'll pass. So let's book another one. And then it was so difficult issuing refunds for the second one that it put me off booking any again, which was probably the right idea. But yeah, I mean, you are a proper fixture of those events because you're voicing them. So I think a lot of people, when they think of the Mist Apex karting, it's your voice that is like, you know, ringing around in their memory.
Yeah, I hope so. I really enjoy doing them. And again, this is just an effect of the experience you have. When I was doing 750 Motor Club stuff with Autosport, I got to watch one of the best commentators at work. It's one thing to listen to a commentator. It's one thing to actually watch them do the job, because what you don't see behind the mic is them flicking between notes, looking at one screen, looking at the other, especially with, like, you know, big things where you can't memorize 150 names.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to Jonathan Simon, doing a similar thing like this. Obviously, he's been doing some Super Cup and some esports stuff, and his big thing was, I wish people could see the work behind what's coming across on the mic.
Yeah, it's a lot of research as well before the fact, and you know, maybe during the Mist Apex iRacing F3 Championship that we do, you can sometimes hear me ruffle my notes a little bit and scrunching up little bits of paper.
Yeah, and we put a lot of effort in. You know, our video guy puts together like track guides and livery guides and all these kind of things for the commentators to use. So that was meant to be things I don't like about Chris. Fine, it descended into compliments. But something I do really, really admire about you is watching you from a kid working in retail to eat food, and then really making that kind of bold move. Well, it was a steady couple of years of really pushing to do Autosport, journalism, blogging, and then finally just to make that leap into PR. And you're living your dream, basically. You are working and living and breathing motorsport.
It's very surreal. It's all I've ever wanted since I was like 13 years old. And I became so enamored with motor racing. I knew I had to build my career around it because it was such a significant part of my life.
Yeah,
I'm so lucky to have actually been able to do that because I'm not good at anything else. Like, I don't really have skills outside of motor racing.
No, you're not attractive or funny. No. You know, you're not fast in a car. You know, what about your day to day now? I mean, you work closely with a lot of professional drivers that I'm not asking you to name names, but drivers we've all heard of, you know, been in and around paddocks, especially particularly in Formula E and Formula 2 in F2. That's got to be so cool to have your finger on the pulse right there.
Yeah, the Formula E one was really big. That was when I was a journalist, and I was at one point I was doing about half the races. Because that's all the budget I could really, you know, afford.
Mm.
I wasn't.
Wait. So you had to finance your own trips to Formula E.
So every flight, every hotel, every meal was all coming out of my own pocket.
That you'd paid for by selling cheap fashion items.
Yeah,
to people.
Yeah, by working at Top Man, it was. And the occasional shift at a Top Shop.
Yeah, and see when you read a lot of those reports and blogs from motorsport events. That's worth remembering that some people are paying for that from like waiter money or waitress money.
Yeah. When you get a really good story, the Albon thing really springs to mind because it was when Albon was supposed to be driving in Formula E. We're there at the first day of testing and he hasn't driven the car at all. And then suddenly it's, because he's going to Toro Rosso to go and do Formula One. And that is a classic thing of you need to be on site to pick up the information and to create a cohesive opinion on things that are happening. And so when you eventually write your article about that, no one sees the blood, sweat, and tears that you put in just to be in that place at that time, because I'd probably saved up so much money for months and tried to pick up extra shifts wherever possible at a job I really, really didn't like. Anyone who's worked in retail knows it can be really horrible. And mine was no exception. I'm not looking for sympathy, but it's just a fact, you know. I'm really glad I'm not working in retail now, during, you know, COVID times. That's like a whole nother level of difficult. In a way, I had it pretty easy. The stuff in working in the paddocks come down a little bit since I moved into PR, but in a way that was a bit of a relief, because I was kind of overworking myself a lot, and suddenly just doing things, okay, I can relax a little bit now, was a big relief.
This is it. A lot of people who chase those kind of dreams end up working essentially two jobs and suffering a financial penalty, which is why so often the people in the coveted positions are people of means and privilege, because they can afford to A, not earn money, B, pay for the flights and accommodation and such like. Whereas for someone like you to do it, you had to really sell your soul for a very small amount of money, which you instantly gave up to go and follow motorsport around the world, which is why I very much admire you, and which is why I get very upset when some established journalists say, well, you just have to get out there and do it, because it's not so easy. You have to push yourself to breaking point. And even then, there was people leapfrogging you all the time for the top positions.
I guess you could say that would be a way of putting it.
The correct exact way of putting it, that happened.
Well, I got really lucky with Formula E, though, to be fair. Like, the fact that something just kind of popped into existence and was just desperate for attention, really, and I gave it to them. So I was able to sort of work my way in at quite an early stage, to the point, you know, a point where not a lot of people were interested in it. And so, putting my flag in there quite early was a big advantage, because they remember things like that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, had you not done all that, you wouldn't necessarily be where you are now, having a proper career, making your way in PR. Before we go, tell me some things about your job that other people might not necessarily understand. Because as far as I'm concerned, your job in PR is occasionally tweeting things, which doesn't seem so hard. What are some PR misconceptions?
Yeah, so I think one big misconception about PR is that we're always here to hide the truth, which is not always the case. That we're here to put a positive spin on things. At the end of the day, we are the ones connecting the team and the drivers or a championship to the media and to the fans, and trying to communicate the best things in a really nice, fun way, because the access to the main characters in motorsport is so limited, because when you see them on TV, we have things like the grid walk, which is amazing, but then that lasts for 10 minutes. And then after that, they're, faces are covered up by their helmets, they're cocooned in a carbon fiber shell, and then they go around in circles for 2 hours. Where do you see the drivers at any point? That for me is a really big part of what I want to try and do in PR, which is just get access to people who don't otherwise have it.
And when you see things like Mazepin and his door joke with Günther Steiner, do you not asking you to comment on that particular exact PR thing, but you must see these PR things all the time where you go, oh, come on, guys, that's lame, or I wish I'd have thought of that.
Oh, more often than not, it's the latter. You're always going to like, oh, man, that's a really good idea.
Off the top of your head, can you think of just like a really good motorsport PR move where you've gone, oh, those guys, well done?
Oh, man, there's so many. I mean, I think, honestly, this is probably a bit of a cop-out, but the Drive to Survive thing is the best thing that Formula One has done, other than creating a video game.
Mm.
But no, do you know what? Even better than that. But, do you know what? Even the esports thing as well in Formula One is amazing, because both of those things just opened up Formula One to an entirely new audience. And for me, Netflix and the video game are Formula One's two biggest assets right now in terms of audience generation.
Yeah. So the last question, I guess, would be, you're kind of like the guy in the other room. Your driver is there and the press are going to speak to him. And you're like, okay, Derek, listen, whatever you do, don't call the stewards cheats. Whatever you do, don't call your rival a potential murderer. And then they go out there and they say, the stewards are cheats and my rival is probably a murderer. And you go, oh, God, what are drivers like to work with?
Well, there's a bit of a mix. Really.
I bet there is.
There is a bit of a mix. But do you know what? Even the ones that are really difficult to work with, and they get a good result, you're still really happy for them. It's amazing how motorsport can just... the I know it's a cliche, but the highs and lows are ridiculous. I had a driver in a team this year who'd had a particularly difficult season, and they recently won their first race of the season. And there I am dancing around the living room in my dressing gown because I was really happy for the guy. But you do get a good mix. You get drivers who are sort of uncommunicative, and you ask them to do something, they don't do it. And this is where the difference between working on site and working off site becomes really, really apparent. Because when you're working on site, you can argue with them a bit more.
Okay.
When you are not working on site, you don't get to build that rapport with them. You don't get to learn how to get them to do things. You know, you don't learn their specific sort of the little nuances and their little systems that you have to get them, you know, to get them to do. And other drivers are just they're so well tuned, either just quite naturally or because they've had quite extensive training.
Yeah. So do you want George Russell or Kimi Raikkonen? You know, I guess you want George Russell.
You want the Russell, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Young, attractive, and good at PR, and is, you know, and he's successful as well. That's just the big bonus.
And finally, which driver was the biggest turnip? No, don't answer that. Instead, I'll say thank you very much, Chris Stevens. Follow him at Chris on Racing. Thanks for dropping into the shed, and I assume because you know no other state of being, you will continue with Missed Apex in 2022.
Oh yes.
I'm so glad that you guys get to hear a little from the panel. And Chris has been one of the longest serving panelists here at Missed Apex podcast. And I cannot stress to you how much commitment he put into building his motorsport career. You know, first pursuing journalism, paying his own way around the world. And he would have been in company with people who had connections and resources. He had none of that stuff and he just kept going. And don't get me wrong, he drives me absolutely nuts because, like all young people, he's kind of stupid. But he has been someone we've all had a lot of admiration for, and the whole Missed Apex team has just been rooting for him and was so happy for him to finally find his feet in PR and do something where he can follow his passion. You know, I felt like a older brother to Chris, except I am actually too old. More like a handsome young uncle. But yeah, we all feel a lot of pride around Chris, and I hope you enjoy his commentary at our motorsport events and his insight here at Missed Apex podcast. That's all we have for you this week. We've got some exciting things and some exciting guests lined up for February. So I hope you'll tell your friends, send them to missedapex.net to check out all things Missed Apex, and make sure you check out the show notes below for links to all the things that we've spoken about. I suspect our next show will be next Sunday, and that it will be live. But wherever we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.